Good afternoon, and thank you for tuning in to Faith and Reason. This is your host, Dr. John Pinero, and I welcome you back to the program. I have a great show lined up for you today. I'm going to be interviewing Michael Matheson Miller. I've known Michael for a long time. He's one of the first folks, I think, that I met in Grand Rapids, although I don't recall how we met or where exactly. Probably at maybe an Acton Institute function.
Or a bakery.
Or a bakery. Well, we've seen you at the bakery a few times there. Michael is research fellow at the Acton Institute and the director of Poverty Incorporated, a film we'll be talking about today. And he's also formerly the director of Poverty Cure. In fact, he directed Poverty Cure for 5 years, and he's now chairman of the advisory committee for Poverty Cure. We'll talk about that a little bit as well. I think we can expect a wide-ranging discussion with Michael, and we're happy to have him on the program. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here, John.
Yeah, the last time we saw each other, I was in Rome with some Aquinas students, dropping them off for their semester, which is one of these onerous tasks I have as a Catholic Studies director.
It's tough.
It is. And lo and behold, here you come down the street with your son. You would probably know the street we were on, but
Yeah, it was right in front of our office in Rome. Of course, so we told Emanuele Due, and I was walking down the street, and I was talking to my son. I looked up, and there you were. And it was one of those things where it was normal that I saw you until I realized, wait a minute, we're not in Grand Rapids. Are you there?
So then we went into Grand Rapids.
Right. And then we went to, all three of us went to St. Paul Outside the Walls.
That was great. Yeah, I had never been to that church before.
It's a beautiful place. Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah, it was good. I think we went, was it dinner the next night, ran into Cardinal O'Malley. It was quite an event, or maybe it was later that night, I think.
Right, that's right. Yeah, with Kishore for who runs our Rome office. Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah, so, I'd like to start off talking about Poverty Cure. And so until recently, you were the director of Poverty Cure. Mm-hmm. And I remember when Poverty Cure was launched, and I have the DVD series myself. I picked it up somewhere along the way. And there's a lot of fascinating tales that you recorded for that DVD series. Can you tell us a little bit about the Poverty Cure campaign? What got it started, and where you see it going?
Well, we did about 200 interviews for this, and so we were able to travel and filmed in about 20 countries, I think, altogether. But the idea of Poverty Cure really is to reframe the discussion about poverty and ground it in the creative capacity of the human person, create an image of God. And really to rethink, we look at poor people and we sometimes think, what can I do to help? And that's important because we're clearly called by God in the scriptures, to care for the poor. You know, St. James says that pure religion is this, to care for the widow and the orphan in their distress and to keep oneself unstained from the world. And, so we're called to help the poor. But sometimes what we end up doing is in desiring to help the poor, we more focus on what we're going to do instead of actually engaging the poor, not as objects of our charity, but as the protagonists of their own story of development. And so, we look at the situation, we think, what can I do to help? And as I said, that's good. But the better question is not what I can do, but how is it that people in poor countries and poor communities, what do they need to enable them to create prosperity for their families and their communities? And so shifting that, I mean, it sounds like a small shift, but it actually changes the way we engage the question of poverty. And so that was kind of our goal, is to reframe the debate and have a large discussion. So like I said, we did about 200 interviews. We filmed in a lot of different countries. And we have a website, povertycure.org, where we have a lot of short videos, and issue pages on everything from, malaria and foreign aid to population control and things like that, which is a big problem. We can talk about that if you'd like. And then we produced a 6-part DVD series, which is about 152 minutes. And so it's, for churches and universities. And I think about 80 to 100 universities are using it right now. And as you said, I'm not involved in the management of it anymore, but my colleagues there are working on a missions project as well, trying to partner with mission organizations, those who send missionaries out, to look at the DVD series. One of the goals of the DVD series is really to help kind of put in context our our understanding of poverty. And it's, I mean, poverty is very complex. There's no single solution to poverty. You know, it's, no one at Poverty Cure, we're not claiming we have the answers to poverty, but we're saying let's rethink how we engage the question and root it really in this understanding of the human being with creative capacity. Because I think, you know, John Paul II said that the primary fault of socialism was that it was anthropological in nature. That is, it got the person wrong. And I think that applies not just to socialism, but across the board. Like when we, if we don't have a rich, realistic understanding of the human being, this creates problems, right? And Aristotle has this great line. I love it. He says, a little mistake in the beginning leads to a big one in the end. And too often our understanding about poverty is rooted in a misunderstanding of the creative nature of the person. And that's where we begin with Christian anthropology, and then go into a whole host of things from entrepreneurship to rule of law, the importance of clear title to land, what we often call the institutions of justice, which are so important. So that's what Poverty Cure is about. And we have 300 plus partners working in 144 countries. And so, yeah, I encourage your listeners to go, if they're interested, go take a look at povertycure.org.
Well, if we can, for a bit longer, then let's get into the anthropological question for a moment. So I know at least wealthy Western countries and wealthy Westerners, and I guess, wealth is a relative term in that one sense, but we often, and we do this at Aquinas College too with our service learning trips. On spring break and fall break, students will go, and they will go to Indian reservations. They will go to the Gulf Coast and areas ravaged by Hurricane Katrina. They will go to the Dominican Republic or Haiti or the Frontera region between the two, where the Haitian refugees come over the border, and then they can't really get help from either country, or and it's unsafe for them, etc. What is the fundamental problem, as you at Poverty Cure saw it? The fundamental misunderstanding that was leading things, let's say, like foreign aid or those well-meaning attempts to help people, what is it that was leading them astray? The little problem that becomes the big problem.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. And again, I mean, these are really complex issues. I think sometimes we like to just simplify.
We have 14
them.
Hours to get. No, we just have 50 minutes.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's maybe enough to solve the world's problems. I think it's important to say that, these are complex. So we also, in addition to poverty, jump ahead and then jump back to this question. In addition to Poverty Cure, we also just finished a full-length documentary film for general audiences. So Poverty Cure is a DVD series. It's hosted by me, actually, which was not my idea, but it's a, for use in curriculum and things like that. Poverty Inc. is a full-length film, and we can talk about that in a little bit. The themes, and we talk actually about Haiti and foreign aid and a host of the things that you bring up. We filmed in Haiti quite a bit. But underlying both of them, even though they're in many ways different products, is this anthropological question. And I think the core of why we did it goes to this question of what you call the subjective dimension of the person, right? And we obviously see a lot of this is influenced by St. John Paul. Right, Pope John Paul II, who really stressed this not only in his work in Love and Responsibility, but in his other writings and of course his encyclicals and the Theology of the Body. The question is really, what is the human person, or precisely who is the human person? And I think that we oftentimes tend to make poor people the objects of our charity, the objects of our pity, the objects of our compassion, instead of the subjects or protagonists of their own story of development. So we turn people into objects. And I think one analogy I give is really comes out of the work of Theology of the Body. In the beginning, when God created Adam and Eve, he created Adam and he put all the animals in front of Adam and he names all the animals. But he was unsatisfied, remember. And so God put Adam into a deep sleep, and out of his rib, he creates Eve, and he puts Eve in front of Adam. And Adam says, at last, mm-hmm. Right? Bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh, at last. And Cardinal Scola, in a very interesting book called The Nuptial Mystery, says that what Adam saw was identity and difference. And he saw identity, this bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh, and difference, female. And in the identity and difference is this call to communion. And from this call to communion, of course, comes not, is not only sublime in itself, but from that comes another subject that God wills for its own sake, right? So like a child is a gift from God, but also a child is willed for its own sake, right? A child is not given, a child is not like the choice of a parent, right? It's not, the end of the child is not for the parents. The end of the child is his own end, willed for his own sake, to be in eternal life with God. So, but anyway, but back to this. So you have this, what you see in Adam and Eve there is this deep intersubjective relationship with identity and difference. Well, when the fall happens, what Cardinal Scola says is that the difference comes in front of the identity and masks it. And so what happens is Adam focuses on the difference. He focuses, and so this is why, of course, they cover themselves, right? Because they were naked without shame. Now they're covered themselves, and they cover, of course, precisely the difference.
Right.
Because, and so what Cardinal Scola says, and a lot of this is really meditations on St. John Paul, is that Adam turns Eve into an object for his gratification. Now, with less gravity, in a less grave matter, but nevertheless, I think similarly, we can turn poor people into the objects of our charity and our compassion and our pity, because instead of the difference, their poverty or their foreignness or whatever it might be, masks the identity. And I think, and this is, I think, a very important thing, because if what happens then is we end up trying to solve problems through social engineering or whatever it might be, instead of being in an intersubjective relationship, we come down and try to solve the problem instead of being in a partnership and treating someone like we would want to be treated, right? If you were in poverty or need, or I was in poverty or need, because we know each other, you wouldn't come up to me and treat me merely like an object. You'd ask me what my needs are, what happened, how can you help? And then we would be in a partnership to help me go into human flourishing. But if we have this objectifying foundation, even if it's not intentional. Now, I'm not saying, and I think it's very clear, I hope it's very clear, I'm not saying that we intentionally go down and objectify people. I'm saying that's what happens. And I think one of the ways to look at it here is really the difference between humanitarianism and Christian charity. And I think too often, even Christian organizations, obviously, big secular organizations are operating out of a humanitarian model. We can talk about that if you'd like. But even Christian organizations have appropriated this humanitarian model where we're going to go down and we're going to solve problems. It's a type of social engineering. And so it has, to use a Nietzschean-like image, limited horizons. It doesn't look at the spiritual dimension of the people. Humanitarianism kind of stops at, we're going to provide comfort, we're going to solve the problems right now. But in contrast to that, caritas, charity, right? Charity is not merely giving away things. Charity is caritas. It is Christian love. And Christian love is to seek the good of the other, right? The philosopher Joseph Pieper has that great definition. It's like, seek the good of the other. And this comes right out of the Thomistic tradition, right? So you're willing the other person's good. It's the intentio benevolentia, right? This is Catholic radio, so I have to speak Latin
just a bit.
We've checked that off.
Well, we're talking about, we're going to go to some fully Latin programming, I think.
Oh, good. Okay. I just wanted to know, because I saw the list say at least one word in Latin. So I did that.
You have mentioned St. John Paul. That's another thing.
Okay, good. Thomas Aquinas, I mentioned him.
Did you already?
Okay. I did. Yeah. Okay, good.
So we'll move on to Thérèse of Lisieux.
And a novena in a minute. Okay, we'll just do a quick novena. All right. So back to Latin. So this intentio benevolentia, this desire for the benevolence, for the good of the other. This is what love is. It is seeking the good of the other. And involved in seeking the good of the other is promoting and encouraging human flourishing in the other person.
But the same thing can be happening, right? If I'm a humanitarian, and it, in terms of especially what we could call emergency aid to help to prevent somebody from starving. I mean, it's not coming out of the same impetus on my part, but it's helping the person in the same way, isn't it? Or is it?
Well, not? I mean, I think this is another really important question, because one of the problems with humanitarianism, and this could happen with charity, I think this is why going back to the nature of the person is so important, is that so often, and we talk about this in the film Poverty Inc., our charity, our, in emergency aid has become the model for doing development. So when there's an emergency, we need to go down and we need to help. And right now you're focused not on human flourishing in the long term, but on just keeping them alive. Mm-hmm. But the end goal is you're keeping people alive. You're helping people alive to solve an emergency so they can flourish, right? So if you remove that end in humanitarianism, which it does, it actually does even affect the way you do short-term giving. And this is why I think we see the development of a poverty industry where – you know, people – like I was talking in Haiti. I was talking to somebody and they were explaining to me, you know, 3 years after the earthquake, people were still giving away free rice, right? It's not an emergency anymore, he says, right? But they're still giving away free rice. And sometimes our emergency aid has become – or not sometimes. Generally, emergency aid has become the model of how we do economic development. And I think – and this has in fact created lots of harm for poor people. And what you're hearing is a lot of people raising voices in Africa and Latin America and Asia saying, look, stop helping us because your help is actually hurting. And I think that philosophy here and theological reflection is not merely like pedantic reflection in the classroom. It actually plays out because if you have a caritas model, that is seeking the good of the other, thinking about human flourishing and keeping the eternal destiny of the person in mind, it actually changes the way you do emergency aid so that it doesn't end up being this long-term 5, 10, 50-year project, you know, where an industry of poverty develops that actually doesn't help people create prosperity for their own families.
Can you give us a specific example of what you're describing, either from – maybe it's from the Poverty Cure series or the newer film, Poverty, Inc., that you directed. Can you give us an example maybe of ways in which – aid is heard in a particular case, maybe Africa. I know you've made many trips there. Or and then in ways in which by paying attention to Christian anthropology and thinking of the person in the way you're describing has helped. I mean, not merely to alleviate poverty, but enable somebody to reach their human potential.
Yeah. Sure. I mean, we have lots of examples in the Poverty Cure DVD series and also in the film Poverty, Inc. Let me give you a couple. So one of the things we talked about right in the beginning is the way foreign aid has done has harmed, say, the Haitian economy. So what we'll often do is we see poor countries think they need food. And so we send over food like rice, for example, as foreign aid or subsidized. And I'll talk about that in a second. But so – for example, with Haiti, we subsidize our own agriculture, we overproduce, and then we send the surplus as foreign aid, and we actually disempower local farmers. Now, again, going back to the humanitarian model, I'm not talking about, like, one of the things you get is like, well, what about short-term aid? Sure, a short-term emergency may be, you know, there's an absolute need for us to give, and you know, sometimes there's a little bit of collateral damage because we're trying to solve problems. I'm not just talking about 2 weeks. I'm talking about years and years and decades of the same broken model of economic development where our foreign aid has actually disempowered local farmers. Okay? And we talk about this in the film. So we ship over rice. Or it's actually subsidized rice. We rig the tariffs, and so it's subsidized rice sold at lower prices. We disempower local farmers. We get people off of the mountains and into cities, not in an organic manner where, you know, you have economic growth.
And a move to cities.
But it's really a social engineering move to cities, which is a different experience. And then you have high levels of poverty. And you don't have any economic independence. This has been one example. I mean, foreign aid has had a lot of negative consequences. But one of the great things is foreign aid actually inculcates and creates a type of crony capitalism where big businesses in the United States and Europe get together with governments and they're benefiting in giving foreign aid. So I talked to a guy in Ghana and he said, you know, he has a software company. Five companies got together. They were about to start a business. They were bidding for a project and everything was going well. And their competitor was a European company who got their government to make a soft loan to the country of Ghana. And the government said, look, we love you guys, but nothing beats free money. And so the entrepreneur said, look, we lost our money. He said, that's not aid. That's not assistance. That's thuggery. So I think you see this development of the poverty industry, but it doesn't just stop at foreign aid. I mean, if you look at, say, for example, non-governmental organizations, another story we have in the film, we interviewed these two guys who started a solar panel factory in Haiti. And it's always interesting when I talk about this, I say, how many people know that they make solar panels in Haiti? And of course, nobody imagines.
No, I didn't know that.
Right. I mean, because nobody imagines that Haitians are
making. Well, we try to make them in America sometimes and even subsidize that the companies go under.
Right. So nobody has this idea. Well, in Haiti, they're making solar panels. So before the earthquake, they were selling about, I think it was 50 streetlights a month. After the earthquake, with increased demand for the need for solar lighting, they sold 5 solar panels in 6 months. Right. Why? Because all of the free solar panels that came in from NGOs actually destroyed their business. Okay. And I remember talking to one of the guys and I said to him, you know, did they know that you were making solar panels? He said, of course, we met them many times. And we were talking about the way that non-governmental organizations or NGOs, you know, come in. And he said, look, when you come in, if you're going to come in, he gave the kind of, you know, the famous example of give a man a fish and everything. He says, but if you've been there for 40 years and you're still doing the same thing, there's a problem. And this is what we see again in this humanitarian. Let me give you a third example, which is directly related to kind of think Christian charity. Another story, this is another Haitian story as well. But when we were in Haiti, we interviewed a number of people, but especially this couple, Corrigan and Shelley Clay, are Americans. They'd gone down to adopt a child, and we tell this story in the film. And they're about to adopt the child, and the orphanage director said, would you like to meet the child's mother? And they were a little taken back, like, was she okay with that? I thought the child was abandoned. Mm-hmm. I said, no, the mother, she's here. She comes to see the child like once a week or every mm-hmm. couple of weeks and brings her things. Yeah. And they watched the mother with the child who was taking care of the child. And they said it was obvious that the mother loved the child. So he said, well, why are you giving this child away? She said, I just don't have any money. And Shelley says, you know, I was shocked. She's like, here I am spending $20,000 on an adoption that for a child that the mother wants. Mm-hmm. Well, as they began to look and work in orphanages, they discovered that about 80% of orphans in Haiti actually have living parents. Right. So they're not biological orphans. They're poverty orphans. And this is the interesting thing. We talked to a lot of different people and we developed this in the film, but that actually Christian charity, and these are well-intended. I'm going to go down. I'm going to help people who are in need, care for the widow and the orphan in distress, because we weren't thinking in an intersubjective model, but I think appropriating some of a humanitarian and also sentimentality. Actually, what happened in Haiti is the incentives were created for parents to give their child to the orphanages. And so Corrigan tells the story. I was talking to this one boy who was 14. He said, are you excited to meet your new mom and dad? And the 14-year-old boy said, they're not my mom and dad. He goes, well, I know, but you're going to get adopted by them. He said, no. My mom and dad are here in Haiti. I know them. Okay. They sent me – I'm just going to the States with these people to get an opportunity. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the couple that was trying to adopt the child, they didn't know this. They mm-hmm. thought they were going to help out this child who needed help. Yeah. And so they were going in with good intentions, but a system had been created of incentives whereby people were actually incentivized to give their children into orphanages, like almost like a boarding school. And so but the interesting thing is the answer to your question is, so what Corrigan and Shelley Clay realized is, wait a minute, why are we caring for children? Maybe we need to give power to the parents. And so they actually created a business. Now they employ over 200 people. And again, we talk about this in the film. And now there are many examples where parents are now able to care for their own children. And this directly relates to not only Christian anthropology, but to the principle of subsidiarity. Sometimes we appropriate like what I would call humanitarian sentimentalism, where we say, oh, the poor children, I've got to help the kids, help the poor children, and we sing songs about the children. But what about the family? And the Catholic understanding of subsidiarity is that we would first try to assist the parents to take care. Now, obviously, now Corrigan and Shelley actually have adopted two children, right? And so there, he always says, we're advocates, he says, for adoption. But we have to make sure that adoption is done correctly. And I think there's an example, really, where a proper anthropology, an understanding of caritas and human flourishing, and a recognition of the importance of the family and the principle of subsidiarity, when it's played out, can be very positive. And when it's not, can actually create incentives for people to give their own children away.
You talk about giving children for adoption. To what extent do NGOs or the UN, for example, predicate their aid on zero population growth, on contraception, et cetera? I remember when I took a trip to the Dominican Republic and Haiti with some Aquinas students, and when we were handing out the vitamins and doing some of the kinds of things you say, and the ladies would come 10 miles on the back of a donkey just to get some Flintstone vitamins and to get a blood pressure check and that kind of thing. And if the babies were in a very bad way, we would take them to the Sisters of Charity, this mm-hmm. kind of thing. And it was done through some Dominicans living there. And but one of the things there's a couple things I recall. One is the great love these parents had. Right. But another is we ran into a group of evangelicals who were on their way, and they had put up posters everywhere that they were going to be holding a clinic. So then there was confusion in the local community. Was it our clinic or this other clinic that they were going to? And halfway through our clinic, the evangelical missionaries came to ours because they had run out of contraception. They had run out of pills, etc., and they wanted to know if we had any we could give them. We said, "Well, no, we're a Catholic outfit. We don't do that." But this was in the middle of you're in the middle of a jungle having this conversation, and I thought,
"Wow!"
So that was a big part of their aid and charity is they saw. I only bring that up as an example. I mean, I'm sure they thought they were doing good.
Right. Well, I mean, you bring up about four or five issues that I think are important. I mean, first of all, let me just start by saying, part of what we're doing at Poverty Cure and Poverty Inc. is we're critiquing the current model of development, which I think is broken. I think it's broken on bad assumptions, and I think the evidence is pretty clear that it's not as helpful as it was intended. At the same time, I want to be clear that we're not saying don't go on missions, don't care for the poor. Mm-hmm. Of course we're called to care for the poor. And one of the things we say is, we are called by God to have a heart for the poor. But we are also called to have a mind for the poor. We're not called to random acts of kindness. Christians are not called to random acts of kindness, like the bumper sticker used to say, right? Christians are called to charity, right? And charity is seeking the good of the other, and charity is a virtue that is guided and ordained by reason and oriented to truth. And these things are not separated, right? And so Benedict XVI in his encyclical, Caritas in Veritate, charity in truth. They're not separated, and there's a deep sentimentalism that can kind of come over. So we have to be careful, but I'm not saying don't do anything. I'm saying not only have a heart for the poor, but a mind for the poor. Okay, now on to your questions. I mean, you bring up a couple things. I mean, I think, first of all, I mean, kind of the large development establishment or the poverty industry has spent billions of dollars on population control policies. And I want to talk about that in a second, but I think the example of the evangelicals, right, doing this, and I think Catholics, do this as well, of giving out contraceptives, is another example of how Christians have appropriated a humanitarianist model, right, and also how Christians are reacting in sentimentality and not thinking about economics. There's no correlation between population and poverty, right? In fact, if there is any correlation between population actually helps with economic development. Now, it doesn't mean that there aren't demographic issues with large movement into cities and things, but the idea that, kind of too many people creates poverty is false, right? There's no correlation there. And one of the reasons we made the DVD series, and we actually talk about this in the DVD series.
The Poverty Cure series?
We talk about the population issue in the DVD series. In the film, we don't talk about that. The film is only 90 minutes, and it's mostly focused on the poverty industry. But one of the things that's interesting is that people will come down to the developing world, and they're on a mission trip. And this is classic. And they're shocked because they see poverty for the first time. I mean, I was, mm-hmm. you were. Yeah. I mean, it's understandable. I mean, we live very, wealthy lives here in the United States. We come down and we see all this poverty and we're shocked. And a lot of times, because of that, we start getting a lot of bad assumptions of how to solve poverty. And one of the reasons we made Poverty Inc. and Poverty Cure is to kind of challenge those assumptions. But especially Poverty Cure, which is a curriculum, and you go through it and you think through it. But one of the first things that happens is people see a lot of children around. And almost immediately think, wow, if there were fewer children, there wouldn't be as much poverty. Mm-hmm. There'd be more stuff to go around. But this is an economic fallacy called the zero-sum game fallacy, which we discuss in detail in the series. Briefly, what the zero-sum game says is that the economy is a pie, and if you have more, then I have less. But that's a fallacy because
that's the old mercantilist model,
right?
I talk about it with the students.
Right. It's a fallacy, and it's but that gets applied to population. Like if there are fewer people, there'd be more to go around. So sometimes when I talk about this, I say, okay, let's imagine you got a room of 50 people. All right, now let's everybody pool your money into the middle of the room. Now, if we divide the room in half and we eradicate half of the room, and now we redistribute the money, is there more money to go around? And the answer is yes. On a snapshot. And it is true that right now, if we put all of our money together and we eradicate half the population, there'll be more money to go around. But we've also eradicated the productive capacity. And in the long run, you actually have lower levels of productivity and less to go around. So what happens is on the zero-sum game, we use a false snapshot of time and we base long-term policy on that. Okay? So it's an economic fallacy, but more primarily, it's an anthropological fallacy. It doesn't recognize the creative capacity of the human person. Human beings are not merely consumers. They're not burdens. They are possible producers of a host of things. And most important, they are mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters created with inherent dignity, with an eternal destiny. And so even if they're not productive, it's a moral evil to eradicate them. But it's also economic, it's not even economically true. So it's morally false, anthropologically false, and economically false. And yet we've spent billions of dollars on population control. And I mean literally billions. Okay. You know, people like to say literally when they mean figuratively nowadays, right? That's like he literally tore my arm off. Like,
no, not literally.
No, he figuratively tore your arm off. I literally mean literally billions of dollars. All right. On population control policy, and we've tied foreign aid grants to it, et cetera, et cetera. And this is a classic example of neocolonialism. This is colonialism and imperialism, you know, of the highest order.
And Pope Francis was talking about this recently when he talked about moral imperialism into poverty-stricken countries by the West with its mores, et cetera.
Right, where it takes
basically –
this is exactly
what I think he was talking about.
Secular values, also values of population growth and says we will give you foreign aid if you impose these morally evil policies. I mean, this is total colonialism.
Dance for your bread.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so it's amazing. You know, you have all these people criticizing colonialism, like McDonald's is colonialist. I mean, please, you're not forced to eat a hamburger, but you're actually not given foreign aid unless you have reproductive programs in your countries. I mean, this is a disaster, and I think it needs to be addressed. So, but let me give you an example of the problem. So, all this money has been spent, and the idea is, okay, if you have fewer children, then well, there'll be more to go around. So, as I said, there's really no correlation between population and poverty. So, reducing population does not increase economic wealth, right? But spending all the money, so it doesn't work in that sense. But these population programs have worked. They haven't worked in eradicating poverty, but they have worked at lowering populations, and especially of a certain type. So when people are encouraged to have small families, and there's contraception, et cetera, and they're incentivized to do this, and abortion, et cetera, what kind of child do they choose?
They choose male children.
They choose boys. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so we have what the Economist magazine has called gendercide. On the covers, the pink ballet slippers, gendercide.
Well, we have that in America too. Right. That's not simply in these.
No, exactly. It's not simply in the developing world, but it is there. What happened to 100 million missing baby girls? And it's not just China. Right? The New York Times called it the daughter deficit. So what we're actually seeing is cataclysmic population decline, especially of female children, because of bad anthropology and bad economics. And the saddest part about it really is that Christians have signed on to a lot of these things. Like, not only the evangelical organization you met, but even Catholic organizations who sign on to things like the United Nations Millennium Development Goals, right? I graduated in the University of Notre Dame. They were signing on with that. The Millennium Development Goals, number 4, improve maternal health, includes abortion and contraception. And so Catholic, even Catholic organizations have signed on to this stuff. And I think this is where really we have to have a little bit more confidence in ourselves. And we have to stop looking to the humanitarians as the source of the care for the poor. I mean, care for the poor and this whole idea comes deeply out of the Jewish and Christian traditions. Humanitarianism is a bad secular copy of Christian love. The problem is now Catholic organizations are actually doing a worse copy of the copy.
Well, and they're instead being, of going when back. Funded heavily. I mean, sure, you know, the funding does not simply come from the church, does it?
So you have to
agree not to evangelize, for instance, in some cases. There's a variety of ways the church is being driven out of, well, especially the adoption
in various
places. But
taking government money is not intrinsically wrong, but I think it's dangerous because mm-hmm. what happens is that you take government money and you end up getting all these strings, and it actually it takes away your independence to preach the gospel. And so this is another problem. I mean, you know, like some of the big Catholic organizations like Catholic Relief Services, and they get, I think it's about 70%. That's the data. That's what we have in the film. Yeah, we talked about this in the film. 70% of their budget comes from government money. Well, you know, there's a Southern line. I know you were in Virginia for a while. It says, if you make a deal with the devil, you're always the junior partner. And if you take government money, you are the junior partner. And that means – you know, it's a serious problem, I think, and it has to be addressed. But I mean, these are very complex. But I think the going back to the main issue of population control, which is, you know, we kind of went off topic there for a minute. But I think it's a real problem, and it doesn't recognize the dignity and capacity of the human being. And so this goes back to kind of a fundamental issue of that we talk about in Poverty Cure and Poverty Inc. is that people are not poor because they simply because they lack stuff. People aren't poor because they just lack stuff. People are poor primarily in the developing world. People are poor because they lack the institutions of justice that enable them to create prosperity for their families and communities. And so, you know, we have this idea, if North American Christians were more generous, we could raise $84 billion, send it to the developing world, and we could eradicate poverty forever. And no, we couldn't, because that's not why they're poor. They're not poor because they lack stuff. They're not poor because there's too many people. They're poor because they lack the institutions of justice that enable them to create prosperity for themselves. And I'll talk about those institutions. But before I do that, let me give you an example. Hong Kong is extremely wealthy and has high population density. Bangladesh has also high population density and is extremely poor. There's not a correlation. I mean, go on and on. Ghana and England have about the same size of land, right?
Mm-hmm.
Ghana's population is 22, 25 million. England's population is about 60 million, right? Which is wealthier, right? It's not on the number of people or the things. It's on the institutions of justice that enable people to create prosperity. And these actually institutions come out of the Christian tradition. And this is why I say Christian organizations, I think, need to be more confident. We need to be more confident in ourselves. We need to go back into our own traditions and realize that we bring a lot to the table. And so let me, a couple of the institutions, if you want to talk about that, you know, we could lay out.
Yeah, the institutions of justice. Let's do that. We have about 20 minutes left on the program. And I should note at this point, actually, while we're paused here for a moment, this is Dr. John Pinheiro, and you're listening to Faith and Reason on Holy Family Radio. And I've been talking for the past 40 minutes or so with Michael Matheson Miller, director of the award-winning film Poverty Inc., and former director of the Poverty Cure and also the what's your title at Acton, research fellow now?
Sir, yeah.
So I'm no longer in charge of the programs.
No. Yes.
So, and you know, this is a very very wide ranging discussion we've been having, but I think that's just shows how interconnected the answers to all these questions all are, and how mm-hmm. I think when Jesus in the gospel speaks of the poor and poverty, we're talking about things as poor in the spirit and not just hungry and ill-clothed. But I wonder when we talk about poverty in the developing world so much. If we might, we'll talk about these the institutions of justice, but in the back of our mind ought to be how this in some way participates in the new evangelization called for by St. John Paul, and which was propelled forward so much by Pope Benedict.
Right.
And I don't know if we can frame it that way, but I'm thinking as you were speaking a moment ago about the what when we take evangelization out of it and Jesus Christ as the answer to the question that is every human life, then we are left with humanitarianism, right? Let's talk about justice, the end of politics, justice, but these institutions of justice. It brings to mind thinking that if you don't have stability and law and order in a country, then you really can't, for example, if you wanted to create a business, you couldn't, could you?
Right. So I'll give a couple examples, and I know we wanted to talk a little bit about the new evangelization, so I'll go quickly through the institutions of justice. But I think, again, like what is it that enables people to create prosperity? Well, there are what we call the institutions of justice. And so these are in some ways intangible, right? You don't see them. When you go into a poor country and you see intense poverty, like we were in a slum called Kibera in Nairobi, or in another place called La Cava, which is outside of Buenos Aires, and you see poverty and it's very tangible. You feel it. But there's these intangible things that you don't see that are actually the most important for really economic development and creating prosperous communities. And these are the institutions of justice. So things like clear title to land, all right? In some places in the developing world, 60, 70% of the land has no title. You don't know who owns the land. If you don't know who owns the land and you live on it, you don't have incentives to improve it. You don't have incentives to build businesses on it because it can be taken away from you. And especially if you're a widow or an orphan, right, where you don't have any political.
So this is the private property argument.
It's clear, yeah. Private property is very important. And private property, as you know, comes out of the Christian tradition. It's presupposed in the Ten Commandments. It's throughout the Old and New Testaments. It's in the Fathers, the Doctors, the Reformers. We also see it in Leo XIII's encyclical Rerum Novarum, where it's very interesting, I think important too. He's talking about private property, right? And then he pauses for a minute and starts talking about the family. Why is he talking about the family? Because private property is more than being an economic thing. Private property creates the space for families to live out their freedom and responsibilities. Private property is a central institution of justice. One of the main goals for it, one of the main effects of it is it allows that space and it allows the passing on of cultus. So Christopher Dawson says that cultus or religion is the driving force of culture. Mm-hmm. Where is cultus? Where is religion and culture passed on? Not primarily in the homily, but primarily in the family. And so private property creates that space. And this is why, interestingly, socialists of all stripes do see three primary obstacles to socialist reform, right? Private property, religion, and this present form of marriage.
You're quoting now.
Yes, I'm quoting. Yeah, exactly.
Marx, isn't it?
I think it's Engels quoting Robert Owen. Friedrich Engels quoting Robert Owen, the English socialist. That it's private property, religion, and this present form of marriage. Mm-hmm. Why? Because they recognize the intrinsic connection between private property, the family, and religion. And sometimes Catholics don't recognize it the way that socialists mm-hmm. do and secularists. So private property is the first one. Well, it also has important economic benefits because now you know who owns the land. You have incentive to improve, to build it. And we actually talk about this in detail in the Poverty Cure DVD series. So I'll just leave it at that and move to the next one. But there's a lot to be said about that. The second institution of justice is what you call access to justice in the courts or rule of law. And rule of law is as opposed to rule of men. And again, this also comes out of Greek's tradition, but also of the Christian tradition. Thomas Aquinas talks about the importance of rule of law. And what access to justice is very important, again, especially if you're a widow or an orphan. And so, for example, in India, there's a research institute in India said that it takes an average of 20 years for someone to get their court case heard. All right. Now, 20 years. And again, if you're poor, it's even longer. So if you don't have access to justice in the courts, if you can't get your contracts enforced, right, then this prevents people from building their businesses and taking care of their families, right? It's an obstacle, this obstacle to justice and thereby an obstacle to economic development. So rule of law is very important. The next one is free association. And free association is related to rule of law in that it's the ability for people to come together and start a business and build a business for which they're competent. Now, Rerum Novarum talks about this as well. This comes out of St. Thomas Aquinas, Contra Impugnates, in 1256, I think it was, where he makes the first argument against monopoly rights. Right? He was defending the right of mendicant orders, Dominicans and Franciscans, to preach. And the bishop said, to teach. And he said, well, no, you can because of this natural right of free association. But this is very important. And let me give you an example, again, that we talk about in both the film and the DVD series. A Peruvian economist named Hernando de Soto did a study where he set up a little sewing machine shop with two sewing machines on the outskirts of Lima. And he said, okay, we're going to try to register this business formally. So he hired four student lawyers and said, you have to take the buses. You can't take, you know, the air-conditioned car with your driver and your lawyer. You take the buses, and like a poor person, you have to try to register your business. So they went and did all the things they had to do, right? How long do you think it took them?
Oh, that's tough to guess. I couldn't say.
Two years? 289 days.
Okay.
Working 8 hours a day.
Wow.
Okay. Which means you can't do that. It's impossible. So poor people are excluded. They are locked out. Pope Francis talks about the exclusion of poor people, and he's absolutely right. Poor people are excluded. They are locked out of markets. They are locked out of the formal economy. And again, if you can't register your business, then it can be taken away from you. But also, it doesn't create a tax base, because if you're not in a formal economy, you're not paying taxes, which also is in part of creating community development where you're not reliant upon foreign aid. And then the fourth one that's very important is free exchange. And this surprises people, right? Because I say free exchange, like, oh, doesn't capitalism hurt the poor? Well, first of all, I don't use the word capitalism on purpose, because it's a convoluted term. It's generally a Marxist term. And there's lots of capitalism. There's crony capitalism. There's oligarchic capitalism. There's managerial Davos capitalism that we have here. You know, all the posh elites. Mm-hmm. They gather in that Swiss resort and they talk about how to plan the economy, you know. So there's a host of things. But what I'm talking about is a free economy, but more precisely the institution of justice that is free exchange. And free exchange also comes out of the Christian tradition, especially in the late scholastic writers, St. Bernardino of Siena and others, who are talking about the importance of ability to buy and sell and make trade without undue burden from the state. Well, why is free exchange so important, especially for the poor? And here's why. When an economy becomes highly regulated, who do you think captures the regulation? Big corporations, powerful interest groups, and entrenched bureaucracy. And the poorest of the poor, and even small business owners, but the poorest of the poor, they lack the political, the social, and the economic contacts to navigate a system that is dominated by bureaucracy.
This was even the case with the National Recovery Administration during Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. The corporations wrote the rules. The small businesses, small businesses suffered.
But do you know the farmer Joel Salatin? He's in our film, but he was also in the film Food Inc. He's been featured in a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And Michael Pollan writes about him. He wrote a great book called Everything I Want to Do Is Illegal. And he's a small organic farmer, a mid-sized organic farmer in Virginia. And he says that, you know, there's so many rules and regulations preventing small businesses that are set up by big corporations in cahoots with government. And this is why a free exchange is so important, because without it, the poor are locked out. And like sometimes you'll hear Catholics talking about things like, you know, the poor are dominated by markets. You'll even hear – and that's false.
Well, you'll hear the critique that maybe you could address this, that free enterprise inevitably leads to concentration of property in the hands of a few, and therefore a free market, free enterprise system – is impossible for any given time, and it produces exactly what you're decrying, crony capitalism or managerial capitalism.
Well, so your question, John, should be a whole other hour. We need to be an hour to do this. But let me just give a very brief answer. And that, first of all, I don't like to use the term inevitably. That's kind of Marxist view of history that somehow it's going to do this. But I think that the point is that no system is perfect, and there's always a tension, and there's always going to be the threat of regulatory capture, all right? And so the alternative, so the whole point is the reason why a free economy is so important is precisely that a free economy means that you're trying to resist this regulatory capture or this mercantilism or crony capitalism, right? Now, of course, it's very possible for a free economy to become an oligarchy. And there, Adam Smith, you know, who's the great proponent of market economy, said, rarely do business people get together that they don't collude and conspire against the general public. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a confusion that we need to put here. I have written about the importance of business. I think business is a moral enterprise. I think it's an important thing. It benefits the common good, and that's a whole other topic. But at the same time, I think sometimes people who defend the free economy end up defending business. And that's a problem because business people oftentimes try to get special privileges and special using their contacts mm-hmm. and actually undermine a free economy. So I'm not pro-business. I am a pro-free and competitive economy precisely because that gives the poorest of the poor the most opportunity. So I think the answer is there a danger that free economy could not be free? And the answer is, of course. Mm-hmm. There's a danger of a free society not being free. I mean, and these are, you know,
that's a human nature thing, not right. A systemic thing necessarily.
Absolutely. And so I think the inherent or inevitability thing, I think, is a mistaken framework. I mean, I think, you know, if you look at Lord Acton, I work at the Acton Institute. So Lord Acton talks about liberty is rare. It is the delicate fruit of a mature civilization. Tocqueville, who has different views on economics, but on the nature of how we very easily will give up liberty for equality and how, you know, the danger, how equality poses a great threat to liberty. I mean, these are the kind of major questions of human life, of how to sustain a free and virtuous society. So I think it's, you know, I don't like that critique, I think isn't really a serious one in that it's not somehow some inevitable nature of the free system, a free economy, mm-hmm. but generally the problem of mankind. How do we create and maintain a free society with all of the struggles and obstacles to do that? But anyway, that's a whole other discussion. But I think back to this just last thing I'd like to say on free exchange is that, you know, so like, for example, in Kenya, coffee farmers, you know, when I was there, I was talking to some people, coffee farmers don't sell their products directly to the market. They have to sell them to the government at a fixed price, and then the government makes the profit. So a free economy is extremely important precisely because it helps the poor. And so this free exchange. So I think these are some of the institutions, but I think it's important to say, and then we can move on for the last part of our conversation, something else. But I think it's important to say that these institutions of justice do not just emerge out of nowhere. They require a certain moral ecology. And I think a lot of, you know, there's a very good book by Acemoglu and Robinson called Why Nations Fail. And it's about, you know, in the importance of institutions and doing more work on the work of Nobel Prize winning economist Douglas North. But in this book, you know, they kind of have this very limited view of culture as just kind of the ways that people relate to one another instead of, you know, habits and food and things mm-hmm. like that, dress. But culture is actually a much deeper and richer concept. And I think like the work of people like Christopher Dawson on culture and talking about how, in fact, these institutions of justice emerge from a certain culture, from certain anthropological, theological assumptions is actually work that needs to be done. And this is some of the work we're trying to do at Poverty Cure and Poverty Inc. and the ACT Institute.
And so then against the argument that says this is more Western – this is more Western imperialism. You know, these are your economic ideas, and the fact that you say they arise out of Christianity makes it that much worse if we're going to apply these in non-Christian areas of the world, and these will be rejected as too modern, too Christian, too Western, that it's the imperialistic Westerners who left Ghana in such a bad place, you know, in the first place. Of course, English is richer than its, you know, than its former colonies, that kind of thing. There's this interesting discussion I see out there shaping up then that you have to, as you said earlier, make a brave case for Christian teaching and Jesus Christ then as the answer and say these things then are growing out of who the human person is and not what the West is. necessarily.
Right. I mean, the West, as we understand it, and now there's the West, this is...
And I'd hate to use it.
This is great. I mean, this is... We should have another hour.
There's another term we should blow up. But at this point in history, I think, the West, we use it too much, I think.
Yeah, and I think it's like you...
Because it no longer means Christendom.
Right, so because West is what Christendom... It's the Enlightenment, but also postmodern secularism. And what do we mean by the West? I mean,
I would reject that, too. If I was in a developing country and they were telling me... not to breed, and here's how I have to dance to get my aid and that kind of thing. It'd be hard not to reject that.
I talked to the Archbishop of Accra, Charles Palmer Buckle, when I interviewed him, and we talked about this. And he says, you know, the West imposes a culture of death instead of the civilization of love, right? And so what we mean by the West and imperialism is deeply complex. And so the effects of colonialism, you know, are very complex. And as you say, I mean, colonialism was a serious problem that creates a host of things, and then there are different types of colonialism, different countries. So, I mean, we could talk about all those things, and they are important. But I think let's go – but since we have about 3 minutes, I guess, let's go back to your other question and maybe end here on the importance of evangelization. And I think one is Christianity, when done rightly, right? And this is like Benedict XVI. He says, you know, sometimes what the greatest witness – that the church has ever given is the holiness of its saints and the beauty that comes from the heart of the church. And this is more, he says, than all the clever excuses we can make up to justify the dark sides. And I think recognizing that, you know, that sometimes colonialism, abused Christian teaching and forced it on people. I mean, this happens sometimes.
And equated Christianity with civilization.
Sure. I mean, these are things that we have to address. But I think fundamentally at its heart, authentic Christian teaching is that Christianity proposes, it does not impose. And it proposes the beauty and the truth of the message of Jesus Christ crucified and Jesus Christ resurrected. But as John Paul would always talk about, Christ reveals man to himself. What Christianity proposes is the clearest articulation of reality. Right. And that, I think, is something we have to recognize. It's not – Christianity isn't like one articulation trying to deal with, like, make up a story about a reality. It's not mythos in the sense of making up a story and, like, the Greek gods. It actually is providing an answer to the mysteries of life. And I think that here's the thing. The fundamental – going back to this end of poverty thing, and I mean going back and ending with the poverty cure discussion, poverty – Christianity, I mean, the fundamental goal of Christianity is to get souls to heaven, right? So to love God and serve him here on earth and to be happy with him forever in heaven. So it's to get souls to heaven and to help create the conditions for human flourishing here on earth. And so that people can live according to the gospel. Now, we can live out the gospel in a concentration camp. It's hard, but it can be done. But as we hear in the liturgy and the prayers and the teachings of the church that we're trying to – that Christianity wants to help create the conditions for people to live according to the gospel, to live out their faith. It just so happens that some of those things that enable human flourishing also enable the creation of prosperity in societies. But the end is not prosperity. The end is not wealth. The end is actually human flourishing. And this is where Christianity brings something to the table that no humanitarian can. And as you say, I think it's where we have to have confidence and not separate evangelization and charity and economic development, but in fact, that they must flow from one another.
Michael Matheson Miller, I want to thank you very much for being on Faith and Reason today. You can find out quite a bit more information about the things we discussed at michaelmathesonmiller.com, acton.org, povertyinc.org, named after the award-winning film of the same name, and povertycure.org. Michael, thank you very much for being on Faith and Reason.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
And this is Dr. John Panera. I wish you a good afternoon.
You've been listening to Faith and Reason with your host, Dr. John Panera, on Holy Family Radio. If you'd like to listen to this program again or share it with a friend, audio copies are available online at holyfamilyradio.net. Dr. John Panero is Professor of History and Director of Catholic Studies at Aquinas College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Faith and Reason is brought to you by Holy Family Radio. I'm your program producer, Michael Fiorenzo. Join us next time as we connect the riches of the Catholic intellectual tradition to daily life. Thanks for listening.